And it is clear that the forthcoming report by Dr. Carsten Smith in Norway will have an extensive section on international law. Carsten Smith, of course, himself was an international law scholar, so but it did not, in fact, occur to the government of Norway when he was appointed a few years ago that international law might become identified as a major subject matter in the inquiry that he was appointed to head. We have had a study which was commissioned in 1971 by the Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities in the United Nations System, a study on discrimination against indigenous populations. That study is not yet completed, reflecting the slow pace of things at the international level. And that, of course, is a major comparative study which will give us the most comprehensive comparative study of state policies that has ever been produced. Because the comparative studies in the past are notable are only about three or four in total number. We've had over the last few years a series of conferences in which the international and comparative aspects of indigenous policy have been stressed. There was a conference organized by the Indian students at Harvard University, I think in 1981. There was an international law conference at Carleton University in Ottawa in January of 1982, and an international law conference in Australia in November of 1983. As well, of course, there have been the two Geneva Human Rights Conferences organized by the Organization of Non-Governmental Organizations, accredited to the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations, both on the questions of human rights of indigenous peoples in the Americas. And those were held in Geneva in 1977 and 1981. It's interesting that even the fact, Mr. Chairman, that you are not a citizen of the United States is an interesting fact in terms of the internationalization of these issues. I was trying to think whether there were any precedents for establishing an inquiry of this type. Certainly there have been some international inquiries, such as the one organized by the Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America, a Canadian interchurch group, which sent a team to investigate the question of indigenous rights in Chile about 3 years ago. The independence constitution of Guyana had provisions for land rights for Amerindian peoples. To fulfill that provision, a commission was established, and the government of Guyana requested the government of Canada to name a person to sit on the commission to give it an international character. Canada nominated Mr. Alfred Scow, who was the first Indian in Western Canada to obtain a law degree and who is now a judge of the provincial court in British Columbia. And he served as, I believe, one of three commissioners who did that report. Also in Canada, during the prime ministership of Lester Pearson, there was a proposal for an Indian Claims Commission modeled on that of the United States, but with the significant variation that it would have an international character. And Mr. Pearson suggested that perhaps a Maori from New Zealand should be appointed to be one of the commissioners. We're happy, of course, that the commission was never established because the model was a bad one, but the idea, the acknowledgement that it is appropriate to internationalize the tribunal is significant. One of the things that may be unique about this inquiry is having indigenous people from outside the nation state come to testify. While there has been comparative work done in other inquiries, the Alaska Highway Pipeline Inquiry, the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry, and the Special Committee on Indian Self-Government, and all of those bodies either held hearings outside of Canada or visited outside of Canada, I don't think it was true that any Indigenous witnesses from outside Canada came to Canada to testify. If I'm right on that, then the pattern here is a step ahead in terms of how an inquiry of this kind would be organized. It's also striking that in the listing of possible witnesses this week, the number of Indigenous people outnumbers significantly the number of non-Indigenous people. The testimony I want to give today is very much still work in progress. Indigenous questions have been so devalued in the scholarly work in the Western countries that there has been virtually no comparative work. And we are now at this point putting together some analogies and some analysis of parallel patterns in different parts of the world. And so I will file with you later this week an updated version of my chronology. The chronology first appeared in January at the small conference that was held here in Anchorage. You have before you today the second version. By the end of the week, you'll have a third version. If I can turn to that then, it is broken into about five or six sections. The first section attempts to outline the patterns of early recognition of Indigenous political and civil rights, beginning with the references to the work of Las Casas and Vitoria within Spanish colonialism and Vieira within Portuguese colonialism. In these patterns of early recognition of Indigenous rights, as I suggested earlier, there was a clear international law framework. These figures were significant figures in the founding of modern international law. We come today back to certain of the questions that they raised. For the question of by what right the Western European colonial powers took over occupied lands in the Americas is not settled. It's striking that in Canadian law, we have no legal theory as to the acquisition of sovereignty over Canada. It is striking in U.S. law that there is disarray on the question of the exact legal theory for the acquisition of sovereignty over what is now the United States. In my article on page 27, I have summarized very quickly what I take to be the major theories on the acquisition of sovereignty by the Western European colonial powers, and I'll just read that. A, prior discovery. But discovery alone does not give rights in international law. That is now accepted. B, this is a listing of the various theories that have been put forward. B, religious or civilizing mission. Well, these were extremely important concepts in the earlier history of Western European colonial expansion, but they are not acceptable bases in modern international law. Even the papal grant of 1493 was rejected as a basis for the acquisition of territories by Franciscus de Vitoria in the early 16th century. And concepts of trusteeship and protection have often been used as justifications for colonialism, but they fail as legal grounds. C, conquest. Conquest is used very loosely in many statements, but conquest is only legally valid in the case of a just war, and that was recognized even in the early Spanish period. As well, under the modern law of war, conquest is not a basis for continuing possession of a territory. D, cession, which is the granting of the rights by the indigenous population. It's often said by indigenous spokespeople that sovereignty is not something that is transferable, that it is contrary to indigenous law. It is not contrary, however, to Western European international law, and so within that context, it is a conceivable basis. So I state the Western European position. The acquisition of populated territories is not colonialism when it is the exercise of the right of self-determination by the population. The decision to become part of another state can take the form of a formal treaty of cession or informal acquiescence. I then comment, it is very difficult to argue that the various indigenous enclave populations gave any free consent to the colonial powers. And E, occupation and settlement. And this, I might add, is the basic thesis in both Australia and in Canada, although more clearly articulated in the law of Australia than in the law of Canada. By this view, indigenous peoples lacked any system of law, and for that reason, there was no barrier to European colonialism. The lands could be treated as unoccupied. This, of course, is an ethnocentric analysis. It was very common in practice, but is no longer acceptable. And specifically, it is in conflict with the advisory opinion on the Western Sahara, the decision of the International Court of Justice in 1975. That completes that brief summary of the major doctrines which have been used. It's interesting that the Senate Committee report published in Australia last fall puts forward two grounds in international law for validating Australian sovereignty over Aboriginal lands. The first one is by citing what is often referred to as the doctrine of intertemporal law. Intertemporal, you can bridge time. And therefore, a right which was valid under the concepts of the time in which it was established is acceptable now. The rights survive even if the basis is no longer considered acceptable in international law. I find this very striking because it's in conflict with the major analyses that I have seen of the doctrine of intertemporal law, specifically the article by Elias, one of the judges from the International Court of Justice, who would find the Australian comments to be totally incorrect in terms of the international law doctrine. The second thing that the Australian Senate Committee talks about is a prescriptive title to sovereignty, arguing that the time that has gone by has meant that the rights, however dubious in their origins, have become less dubious as they have matured like fine wine. This doctrine is, I think, extremely suspect. The committee itself notes the analysis of the long history of resistance in Australia by Aboriginal people to the presumptions of the settler population. And on the point, I will table with the Commission a paper which I've recently done called The Search for Recognition in International Law, which attempts to document the attempts largely by Canadian Indians to raise these questions both within the structure of the British Empire and internationally. This kind of information has not been valued and has not been brought together. And so the assumption has been possible that indigenous peoples acquiesced in the presumptions of sovereignty put forward by the Western European colonial powers. However, as more research is done on these questions, it becomes clear that there was not acquiescence, that whenever there were opportunities to protest the assumptions that were made, those opportunities were taken. That makes the doctrine of prescriptive title to sovereignty argued in Australia, I think, untenable. The second aspect of my first heading in the chronology, the patterns of early recognition, goes from the international law recognition to patterns of significant domestic law commitments developed by various European powers. Documents such as the Royal Proclamation of 1763, the Northwest Ordinance, the New Laws of the Indies, the Papal Bull Sublimis Dies, the patterns of treaties, and certain of the early court judgments. Now, the second heading, which begins lower on the page, is headed the undercutting of indigenous rights and the consolidation of unilateral national jurisdiction over indigenous populations. Now, it becomes important to try to understand how this reversal occurs. This involves two elements. First, the domestication of indigenous questions, so the junking of the idea that these are properly questions of international law. And secondly, not only their domestication, but also a reversal of patterns in domestic law. So the patterns, the commitments that had been made in the Royal Proclamation, in the Northwest Ordinance, and in the treaties are reversed, because those documents did not involve the assumption of internal jurisdiction over internal matters on the tribes, and did not explicitly assume unilateral decision-making. The Royal Proclamation talked about a principle of consent, treaties. The Northwest Ordinance talked about consent. Lands were not to be taken without consent. The treaty pattern was consent. Therefore, you had a model of how domestic relations were to be handled by agreement, by consent, by treaties. By the end of the 19th century, that model had been abandoned. So even the domestic law principles which had been established had been reversed. Colonial governments, settler governments, had assumed unilateral jurisdiction to alter the terms of treaties, to establish relationships with additional tribal groups without going through a consensual relationship. Now, how did this happen? There are two aspects which I've identified. The first is intellectual or philosophical. By the end of the 19th century, you had various intellectual systems which were hostile to the collectivist traditions of indigenous tribal groups. In the late 19th century, you had, particularly in Central and South America, what are referred to as liberal reforms. These involved values which were nationalistic, they were rationalistic or scientific, and they were individualistic in their orientation. The use of the term liberalism is a bit dangerous, because in the liberal tradition there's also a concept of tolerance. And so this is one of the streams of the liberal tradition which was hostile to difference and sympathetic to the individualism which was characteristic of the capitalism of the period. This was not, however, a capitalist plot. The plot was more extensive, because you find in Marxist thought an analysis of the evolution of societies from more primitive to more modern structures. And those systems of thought were also hostile to respect for traditionalist systems. Those systems were archaic. They must change, they must pass away, they would be replaced inevitably by more modern forms. And so you did not have in Marxist thought, and there developed a tradition of Marxist anthropology, you did not have in that any respect, conceptually, for tribal societies. You also had social Darwinism, which has come to be perhaps the most strongest, the system of thought most strongly identified with the hostility to tribal systems in the late 19th and early 20th century. Some good work has been done in Scandinavia, analyzing the impact of social Darwinist thinking on Scandinavian governments in terms of Sami policy in the late 19th century. You also had the philosophy of Comte called positivism, which, while it is not remembered as having much impact in North America, was extremely pervasive in Central and South America. And so the intellectual milieu in Western thought in the late 19th century was individualistic, rationalistic, nationalist. In the romantic schools of northern landscape painting that occurred both in Canada and Scandinavia in the latter part of the 19th century, you have wonderful romanticism about the land and no depiction of northern peoples. The romanticism did not extend to the northern tribal populations. So that's one aspect. A second aspect, and it's perhaps a more common analysis of what happened, was simply that there was a shifting power balance. When the relations between the European colonial powers and the tribes were more evenly balanced, when the European colonialists needed indigenous allies, it was in that kind of period that there was a recognition in domestic law of rights of indigenous populations. When the power balance in the eyes of the colonial powers was irrevocably shifted in their favor, then the need to recognize was lessened. Also, frequently, the latter stages of contact with tribes were contact with hunting groups in which the political units were relatively small and the population density relatively small, situations in which the intrusion of alien populations was much easier, situations in which resistance was much more difficult. In any case, for a combination of these reasons, presumably, unilateral jurisdiction was established, at least in the minds of the settler governments that had become established. And when the League of Nations was formed after the First World War, the question of putting some minority rights provisions into the covenant of the League was discussed. The governments of Australia and New Zealand, acting through the United Kingdom, succeeded in having no provisions on minority rights inserted in the covenant of the League because they wanted no international investigation of their treatment of Maori and Aboriginal peoples. The pattern of undercutting indigenous rights, which occurred in North America in the late 19th century, occurred as well in Central and South America. It occurred in Scandinavia, in which prior patterns of recognition of Sami territorial rights was transformed or translated or revised into simply a right to herd reindeer, divorced from any property rights in the territory that was necessary for reindeer herding. And even in Japan in the late 19th century, a prior pattern of recognition of Ainu territorial rights was replaced with a system of allotments apparently modeled on the Dawes Allotment Act in the United States. The Dawes Allotment Act, of course, was the great blow against collective land holding, against the reservation system in the United States. And later in 1928, the Merriam Report suggested that the Dawes Allotment Act had laid the foundation for 20th century Indian poverty in the United States. The third section of my analysis, which begins on the second page of the chronology, indicates some retreat from the policies of the late 19th and early 20th century. And I headed collectivist reforms of the 1920s and 1930s. One, I think, starts to see the connection between minority rights concerns in international law and the treatment of indigenous populations as a specific subject matter. While minority rights provisions had been deliberately excluded from the Covenant of the League of Nations, nevertheless, in the European peace treaties that marked the end of the First World War, there were specific minority rights provisions for named minorities in specific countries who had been defeated in the First World War. And the system of that limited system of minority rights was under the supervision of the League. Therefore, you had, really for the first time, the internationalization of some minority rights concerns. It wasn't principled, and no general principles were established, and it wasn't systematic, and it was not seen as successful in the end. But nevertheless, it is one of the major policy innovations in international law which is associated with the League. And a couple of significant things do come out of it. In the decision of the Permanent Court of International Justice on the question of minority schools in Albania, which has to sound like one of the most obscure references that I will come up with today, you have established in international law the principle that equality does not mean equal treatment. That when you have minority populations who significantly differ from majority populations, a uniform regime of law within the state may in fact discriminate against the minority population. The principle is therefore established that to have equality in law and fact, the phrase used in the decision, it may be required that there be differential treatment, and therefore the minorities were entitled, in order to maintain equality, they were entitled to maintain their distinctive school system. As well, in the international arbitration on the Åland Islands, a system of regional autonomy was developed within the state of Finland for the Swedish-speaking majority on the Åland Islands, a model that has been referred to many times since the decision was put into place. As well, I haven't integrated this in, you have in the creation of the Soviet Union after the October Revolution, you have the recreation of the old Tsarist Empire on the new principle of the free association of nations within a multinational state. And some of the most sophisticated writings in terms of respect for the political autonomy of separate populations within a nation state. The reality of that, at least in modern times, has often been challenged, but the theoretical work in terms of the structure of the Soviet Union is fascinating and extremely well written. And it may be that it had some impact on the pattern of collectivist reforms that happened in Western countries during the period between the wars. You have also in Mexico a realignment of national symbolism after the Mexican Revolution and the development of a policy entitled indigenism, in which respect for pre-contact cultures and languages is established as a major part of state policy. You have a United States equivalent in the Indian New Deal, which produced the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, and I mentioned a couple of other more minor parallels in the same period. New Zealand reforms of some reconsolidation of Maori lands and Japanese reforms of some reconsolidation of Ainu lands in the same period. The only impact in Canada, you mentioned the roller coaster phenomenon in the United States. In Canada, we seem to have been much calmer, not gone through quite as dramatic of fluxes. But in the 1930s, there were reforms in relation to Métis people on the prairies and the establishment of a system of Métis colonies in Alberta under the Métis Betterment Act of 1938. It's the major Canadian reform in the period. I next turn to the period after the Second World War, what I call the termination reforms of that period. Termination is a term, of course, most clearly identified with the United States. But if one tries to survey the various kinds of countries I'm talking about in the periods immediately after the Second World War, one finds that the policy of assimilation, as the most common term, is firmly in place. Integration and assimilation. Various countries are boasting that they have an enlightened policy of assimilation. That's how limited the debate is in that period. And again, there's a relationship between indigenous policy and minority policy in general. Because after the Second World War, minority policy was out of favor internationally. It was seen that Hitler had exploited minority arguments in consolidating power vis-a-vis German minorities in other countries. That had significantly led into the Second World War. The League of Nations, which of course seriously discredited minority concerns, the League of Nations was seen as having been very concerned with minority rights and having been a very significant failure. And so you didn't get any positive carryover from the League's work. The Cold War atmosphere after the Second World War also seemed to be hostile to respect for difference. You also had a strong period of U.S. cultural and political hegemony, and with the U.S. melting pot theory in terms of its internal social patterns and a human rights policy now projected internationally from the United States, which stress individual rights. And so in the Charter of the United Nations, you have a commitment to human rights, but in individual rights terms. And while self-determination of peoples is mentioned, you do not get internal concepts of the application of that principle. You don't even get, immediately after the Second World War, any international law commitment to decolonization. That takes at least another decade before it enters international law as some kind of principle. So, in terms of termination, you have the U.S. Indian Claims Commission Act of 1946. It's terminationist because any rights which have been improperly taken away are to be translated into monetary compensation only. No land is to be restored. No additional rights are to be recognized. And the United States then, in parallel, pursues policies of paying off claims, buying off the past, in a sense, and formally terminating the special legal status of Indian tribal communities within the United States. And you get the House Concurrent Resolution 108 in 1956, expressly stating the policy of termination. Public Law 280 in 1953, a major move in bringing state jurisdiction onto the reservations in the United States. I also include in this list the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 because of the termination feature that is built into it. The developments in international law of human rights during the period do involve a convention by the International Labour Organization on tribal and semi-tribal populations, which states very clearly the goal of assimilation, and the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which allows temporary affirmative action programs for racial minorities, but stresses very much that these must be temporary. They must not be perpetuated beyond the time that they are needed. Also included in this group of actions is the Canadian White Paper of 1969, in which we proved again that we don't learn lessons from the United States and repeat old errors with a lapse of time of perhaps 10 or 15, or to our great embarrassment, sometimes even 20 years. You also had in 1972 one of the, a very symbolic story which one comes across every once in a while. There was a trial in the state of Colombia in South America of a group of farmers who had shot a number of Indians. It was seen as very significant that these farmers were brought to trial. This had not happened in the past. The farmers, in their defense, said that they had not understood that it was a criminal offense to kill Indians. They did not regard Indians as being human. They were convicted at trial. The appeal went to the Colombian Supreme Court, and they were acquitted on the basis of their statements that they did not understand it was an offense, the court noting that measures to protect Amerindian populations in Colombia were very recent. That's a kind of symbolic story. It's a true story. It got covered in the press at the time. There were also the stories of the ethnocide and genocide in the selva and forest interior of South America, which became, the set of stories became a major stimulus to international humanitarian concern for indigenous populations. I use that as a bit of a transition to what I suggest is the current pattern in which we have had a reemergence of concern for indigenous populations, both in the domestic law of various countries and in international law and in international institutions. And I list again in this heading the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 and the Indian Claims Commission Act of 1946, because I think there are mixed signals to both of these acts. Indian questions cannot simply be dismissed. In both of the acts, institutions are established, compensation is paid, there's a recognition of the reality of rights or claims, and that some response is necessary, but both are terminationist in their character. I list in B and C and D some of the developments which initiate the period that we are in. There were major political struggles in the United States against termination. There was the mobilization of Indians in Canada against the White Paper of 1969. There was intense Maori political activity in New Zealand against the Maori Amendment Act of 1967. These were extremely important in launching the political activism that we now see as a standard logical part of the ongoing questions of the relationships between tribal populations and nation states. In C, I attempt to give a short list of demonstrations, most of which are familiar to people. A lot of people remember the Alcatraz occupation, and certainly Wounded Knee was phenomenal in terms of the press that it got around the world. If I could indulge myself, I remember hearing about it in the newspapers in Papua New Guinea when it was going on, indicating how widespread the publicity about the occupation at Wounded Knee was. In D, I list the establishment of support groups internationally. Of course, there had been support groups established a century before, with the establishment in about 1834 of the Aborigines Protection Society in England, and then the establishment in about 1912 or 1916 of the International Bureau for the Defense of Indigenous Populations in Geneva. But in terms of the organizations that are presently active, those are formed really in the last 15 years, and I think the first significant one to develop was the International Work Group for Indigenous Affairs in 1968. There are then the developments of the international indigenous organizations, the International Indian Treaty Council in 1974, the World Council of Indigenous Peoples in 1975, I think the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, am I right? It's 77. I realized that in two separate documents I had written two separate dates. Correct this to 1977. The Indian Law Resource Center in 1979. Those three organizations, together with a newer organization, the Four Directions Council, all have been accredited as non-governmental organizations by the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. The matter of indigenous rights gets onto the agenda of the United Nations as a byproduct, or in the context, is perhaps the better way to put it, of the concern of the United Nations with racial discrimination. And it is out of that concern that the study, which is still ongoing, was proposed and was commissioned in 1971. The terminology significantly begins to change. In the United States, one of the major changes from the termination terminology was in the 1972 Nixon statement, perhaps one of the few things that he's remembered for warmly, at least outside of the United States, in which the terminology of self-determination was accepted by Nixon, clearly in a domestic concept, to describe the proper situation of the Indian tribes within the country. The term self-determination is a very interesting one. It is seen by some governments as politically loaded. Self-determination of peoples was most commonly understood in international law as meaning full decolonization, and therefore the emergence of the people as a separate sovereign state. There has been evolution in international law on this question, and so now it is fair to say that that is not the only meaning of the term self-determination. Self-determination can be exercised in a number of ways, including compacts of free association, such as exist with Micronesia and some of the South Pacific Islands with New Zealand, and it is logical that there can be a what would otherwise appear to be a domestic realization of indigenous rights, which nevertheless can be seen as a fulfillment of the right of self-determination in international law. It isn't black and white as it was perceived to be in 1960 when the UN Declaration on the Ending of Colonization was passed by the General Assembly. Canada has had particular troubles with the term self-determination because of the separatist claims of nationalists in the province of Quebec. And so to this day, you will not find the Canadian government throwing around self-determination loosely. The Senate report in Australia of last fall both says that we must not say things which give Aboriginal people a claim to self-determination. We can't use international law, quote, quote, we can't use nations, we can't use sovereignty. It says that in one section, and then in other sections it actually uses the term self-determination. Even as radical a source as the World Bank in their report, Tribal Peoples and Economic Development, seems to have no problem in using the term self-determination at a couple of points in the report, although they don't touch sovereignty. So we're having some loosening up of terminology, and self-determination has become, in many ways, the most pervasive term presently being used to describe aspirations for self-government, self-determination, self-control, self-rule, regional autonomy, political autonomy, whatever other terms are being used at the present time. I note in my listing under this section, and this is sub J, the question of individual rights versus collective rights emerged in litigation in both the United States and Canada, and there were some parallels in other countries, and emerged before the Human Rights Committee of the United Nations under the terms of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The U.S., and that was a case from Canada, these cases posed individual rights questions against the collective question of the determination of tribal membership. These cases had the potential of attacking the collective notion of tribal membership as a separate grouping of rights within Canada and the United States, striking that the decisions involved all sustained the collective systems as opposed to the individual rights systems. So in that litigation, the individual rights arguments did not succeed in attacking the collective rights systems. Some criticism of the details of the collective rights systems were involved, but no challenge to the basis, to the concept of the collective rights system, was involved. I note in N the decision of the International Court of Justice in the advisory opinion on the Western Sahara. Here, a population in the Western Sahara, which by earlier international law standards,